Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Coming this May from Heritage Radio Network, the surprising stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in one special Brooklyn community that's changing faster by the day.
I am 28 years old. I live in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
When I moved to Brooklyn, I chose Bushwick randomly.
We recently opened up in Bushwick.
All over Bushwick.
Bushwick.
Brooklyn, Bushwick.
This is Bushwick Podcast, a series that takes you behind the scenes of how people in kitchens, shops, and countless other community spaces create New York City's most dynamic neighborhood. Each week, we step into the journeys that define Bushwick and break down the forces competing to shape its future. These are local stories like you've never heard before. Join us this May, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Joining us from Malaysia by phone is Dr. Gaik Chen Koo. Especially interested in the ways and reasons we gather, Dr. Koo has written extensively on food in public spaces, culinary identity, and cultural appropriation. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Coral.
So if you and your research aims could be encapsulated in one single dish, what would you be and why?
Ooh, that's a difficult one.
Hard question.
Me?
Mm-hmm. You.
Maybe rojak.
And why is that?
So I've chosen a very Malaysian dish, kind of a salad that is also sometimes used to represent Malaysia's multiculturalism. I choose rojak because it's complex and it's got many types of fruit in it. So that all kind of contribute slightly different flavors and tastes and different kinds of tanginess and sweetness. And then the sauce, which is salty because of the shrimp paste, sugar, and also tamarind, I think, and chili, because I think I've got many aspects to my research as well as to myself.
And yeah. What are the fruit components?
So we use jicama, and we use pineapple, cucumber. Sometimes there are other kind of more local fruits or seasonal fruits, like it's called jambu. It's kind of a watery fruit. It's red, which is nice, and then kind of white inside and has a bit of crunch, but isn't as crunchy as the jicama. And then what else do we put? Star fruit sometimes. And when I was growing up, they used to have these small mangoes that are really sour. So they'd have small pieces of that. And if you live and grew up in Penang, some of the stalls would have pieces of nutmeg, preserved sweet, you know, sweet nutmeg in it too. Yeah.
I think rojak perfectly sets the tone for our episode and our conversation, so thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So you write that your writings are a form of culinary nationalism, but not quite Malaysian pluralism. So can you explain what that means and why you feel this way?
It's not so much all my writings. It's a particular essay I worked on recently that's coming out in a book called Culinary Nationalism in Asia. And in that book, I'm talking about modern Malaysian cuisine. So the modern Malaysian cuisine is very much chef-led. So in a way, it's more, you know, elitist. So it's really looking at the fine dining market and trying to do something more experimental and new. So it differs from pluralism, Malaysian pluralism, because it is trying to move away from how we understand Malaysian cuisine. So are there any Malaysian cuisines, restaurants where you live?
Very few. There's one kopitiam which I feel like has the spotlight, but very few.
Oh, what's it called?
It's called kopitiam.
Oh, okay, yeah, I saw that. Actually, I had a quick look, and there are like 20 in New York alone.
I'm just completely not in the know.
But I think the problem is that they're all little, because of land, I suppose, the cost of land and rentals and stuff, they're all tiny little places that are spread out, or not so spread out on the island, in Manhattan itself. And I had a friend who used to live in Brooklyn, and he told me there was a Penang restaurant there. I'm not sure if it's still open. Mm. So there are. It's just that Malaysian restaurants don't get the same kind of attention that Thai restaurants or Vietnamese restaurants get, or overseas, I think. But when you do go to a Malaysian restaurant, what do you order, and, you know, what's your understanding of Malaysian food?
Super basic. I went to Malaysia when I was really young because my family friend's Malaysian. And I just remember having the best seafood. I was so young. I remember the shrimps were as large as lobsters, and that was what I remembered.
So Malaysian food is plural in the sense that it reflects Malaysia's multicultural diversity. So you have Malay food, so things like satay and rendang. Rendang, I'm sure you probably know, it's a kind of beef curry that's not soupy, but more thick, and traditionally the beef rendang originates from Sumatra. So in Malaysia, we've got migrants, you know, from around the region, and they brought their food with them. So we've got Malay food, we've got Chinese. So the Chinese and Indians were brought in under the British, the Chinese mostly in trade. Actually, the Chinese had been there longer before the British came, but most of them came in the late 1800s to work in the tin mines. And then the Indians also were brought in from southern India to work in the rubber plantations. Mm-hmm. So these people, of course, brought their cuisines with them. And oftentimes, when you go to a Malaysian restaurant overseas, you'll see that there'll be a few. It's hard to kind of pinpoint what kind of cuisine Malaysian food is when you are only familiar with, let's say, Chinese restaurants or Indian restaurants or Thai, which is very, very kind of unique because we are multicultural. Okay, so like I have a friend in Germany, and she opened a Malaysian restaurant, and she said it took her 8 years to educate Germans about what Malaysian food is. Because the first time they come, they're like, well, what kind of restaurant is this? It's not quite Indian. It's not quite Chinese. It's got like everything thrown in. Like, couldn't you be original? You know? Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of multiculturalism in our menus that make us difficult to market, at the same time as it's also, I think, our strength. So Malaysian food is often known to be, you know, a little bit of everything, like a bit of Indian food. So in Malaysian restaurants overseas, you see roti canai on the menu, and maybe Indian noodles, or fried Indian noodles. Okay, so that the Indian noodles is a very Malaysian thing, because you don't get fried Indian noodles in India. Mm-hmm. No, it's because when migrants came from Tamil Nadu, these would be Indian Muslims or Tamil Muslims coming, they actually incorporated noodles and tofu into and made this dish with spices. So it's something that's very Malaysian that everybody eats. Mm-hmm. So then you also have Chinese dishes or Malaysian Chinese dishes. So Malaysian Chinese dishes if you're familiar with Chinese food, it's also quite distinct. There are sort of Cantonese-style dishes, but there are also Malaysian-Chinese dishes that originate from Malaysia through this sort of migrant experience. So something like the bak kut teh, which is a herbal pork soup, originates from Malaysia. So Singaporeans also like to claim it as their own. So going back to modern Malaysian cuisine, it's different because they're trying to move away from how Malaysian food is, you know, multicultural and reflects Malay, Chinese, Indian, and Eurasian, and, you know, these people, but these people's migrant food. They're trying to boil it down to ingredients. So ingredients that you can find in Malaysia, specifically herbs and plants. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So before we get into modern, because Malaysian, or what is understood to be Malaysian cuisine, is so inherently mixed and appropriative, are Malaysians as sensitive to cultural appropriation as I feel like we are here in America?
We're only sensitive when other nations claim our food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for example, I think you, in your interview with Andrew Tam, in a previous episode on hawker food, Singapore is going up, trying to claim that hawker food is their heritage under the UNESCO listing, and Malaysians are kind of up in arms because some of the dishes that they're claiming are actually originated from Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
So there's now a proposal in the Penang state government when they have their, you know, parliament or whatever, and some backbenchers and people are talking about how Penang should try and do a joint bid with Singapore to claim hawker food as equally our own. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's after the ruckus that Malaysians kicked up, there's also a proposal, okay, we'll include Malaysia, so it'd be like Singapore and Malaysia. But I think some of the Penang politicians are saying, well, some of these dishes are actually specifically more Penang than all over Malaysia. Why not let's be much more specific about it and say that it's, and claim it for Penang? So we'll see. I think it's very much a political move. So in that sense, yes, cultural appropriation only matters when it's outside the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Malays and Chinese and Indians are, I think, not as sensitive about each taking or adopting each other's food, but they are more sensitive when it's another nation claiming that food as theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking about food being a way we demonstrate power, whether over ourselves and our bodies by taking on an extreme diet, or over others, like Singapore claiming this as a heritage, immaterial heritage. You also talk about the tension between hosts versus guests, how some communities have more agency in certain food spaces than others. So can you explain this too?
Oh, okay. So it's actually an idea from a concept from an anthropologist. I keep forgetting his name. But basically, my co-author and I, Jean Drew and I, in our book, Eating Together, Food, Space, and Identity in Malaysia and Singapore, we're looking at how people can eat together, you know, having a sense of commensality where people of different ethnic backgrounds or class backgrounds can come and eat together. In Malaysia, it's particularly difficult because the majority ethnic population is Muslim Malay, and Malays are how do you say that? Malays are constitutionally defined as Muslims, so they can't get out of it. And from the 70s onwards, there's a kind of there's a kind of resurgent awakening that Malay Muslims have not been strict enough in observing halal, you know, halal strictures. This happened because of what's happening in Iran, 1979, with the rise of the Ayatollah, and yeah, and so there's a kind of missionary zeal in making Muslims, making Malay Muslims, much more conscientious about their, not so much spirituality, but their religious, about being better Muslims. Okay, so what you then have is a much stronger observation of halal. So halal is just a term that means what can and cannot be eaten. And it's not just eaten, actually, but, you know, what can and cannot be eaten for Muslims. So this would be pork, alcohol, and also the process of getting that food onto the table has to be halal. Okay, so it has to be clean from impurities like, you know, animal blood and urine, feces. So the cook in the kitchen has to be a Muslim. And today, because the Malaysian government has been promoting halal, the halal industry, it's a kind of certification that the government, Malaysian government, I suppose, gives out to food businesses to certify that they are halal in order for Muslims to feel confident that, oh, I can go and eat there and the food there will be halal. You know, so you make sure that the chickens and the beef and the lamb are kind of slaughtered according to the Muslim way. So that's another way to observe halal for food. So wait, let me see, where was I? So how this is one way. Halal kind of means that the Chinese who eat pork, and the Indians who, if they're Christians or whatnot, who also eat pork, in order to be together, in order for Muslims and non-Muslims to eat together, we would have to eat at a halal eatery or at Malay's house. Because Malay Muslims are becoming much more religious, much more observant of halal, they are fearful of eating in places that are not halal, even though they themselves would not be eating pork or, you know, drinking alcohol in restaurants that do serve those things or in restaurants that don't have that halal certificate at the front door.
So
this also feeds into, for example, when non-Muslim Malaysians invite their Muslim friends over to their house for their religious festival or, you know, just to come and eat, the more religious, the ones who want to observe or more conservative Muslims will be quite reluctant to eat anything at that person's house. They might, you know, maybe have a drink that's in a box or, you know, because they're worried that the food that's cooked to them will be cooked in pots that have been cooking, you know, pork or whatever. So if you actually follow that very, very strictly, that pot has to be, you know, clean with sand, particular sand or whatever, for like 7 times before it's considered pure or clean. You know, so in order to, like, not have to deal with that, then Muslims don't actually attend non-Muslim religious festivals as much anymore these days, particularly the ones who are more conservative. And so what we then have is that Muslims can host non-Muslims because, you know, those who eat everything can go and eat in a Malay household. But the non-Muslims cannot host the Muslims, and therefore, we're, as migrant, as people with migrant ancestry, considered always as guests in this land, in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Malays, who are considered sons of the soil, you know, Bumiputra, they have this status called Bumiputra. They are then seen as the perpetual host, and we are the perpetual guest. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And so is this increase in halalization of food, does that figure forth in modern Malaysian cuisine?
No. No, because, let's see, because the chefs, because we're talking about fine dining here, and if you only do halal, it means you can't sell alcohol. You know, so, and that also means, and actually, if you look at who are frequent diners, who are the ones who are, who can afford to eat at fine dining, who are the ones who eat out the most, they're actually, well, mainly the Chinese. So if you were to say, if you were to limit the modern Malaysian cuisine to halal only, then that would mean that you're shooting yourself in the foot because you're already narrowing down the market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't mean that Muslims don't go. It's just that the liberal Muslims would go. But see, so there are different degrees of accommodating Muslims. So in these restaurants, they wouldn't actually have pork sometimes on their menu. Okay, they would have chicken and maybe duck, and they would also have vegetarian options, but they sell alcohol. So it's up to the individual whether they want to go there or not, but it won't have a halal certificate in the front door.
Mm-hmm. So then who or what is quote-unquote modern Malaysian?
Who or what? Let's do what is easier. Modern Malaysian cuisine is chef-led, and it's very much influenced by Noma and the kind of, you know, back to the roots, local, fresh, and the emphasis on local fresh ingredients. So not everybody does that. So since I started writing on it about 2 years ago, like today, there's more than just one chef, more than just Darren Teo, who proponents of modern Malaysian cuisine. So now I can see at least three or more of these restaurants that focus on modern Malaysian cuisine and focus on local ingredients first. Though I think that it's hard to just use local ingredients. So the local ingredients that most people focus on are herbs. And because Malaysia is traditionally, the traditional things that people eat in Malaysia, you know, for centuries would be seafood, because we are a peninsula and in East Malaysia and a kind of island. So seafood is very big. And so the emphasis is on seafood and even preserved seafood. So you like your fish sauces in Thailand and in Vietnam. We have the shrimp paste. We have a kind of fish sauce, but it's actually called budu. So it's also kind of a preserved fish, but it's watery. It's a kind of fish or shrimp paste sauce. And we have several of that from the east coast of Kelantan and Terengganu, Budu. So you can try to incorporate those kind of preserved shrimpy type sauces in and flavors in your food. So if I were to define not so much who, but what is modern Malaysian food, yeah, it would still be traditionally the kinds of flavors that Malaysians are used to.
Mm-hmm. And so,
and some of the ingredients that are herbal.
Mm-hmm. And though the ingredients may be inherent to Malaysian cuisine and the environment, you write that many of the techniques are European or French, or even, you say, inspired by Noma. And so why is this somewhat problematic that modern Malaysian cuisine still has to kind of be defined to exist within a Western narrative?
I know it is problematic. I mean, as a kind of post-colonial scholar, mm-hmm. It's Malaysian mindsets also have to decolonize or decolonialize. Partly because if you were to ask people to pay, you know, 300 ringgit, that's, I don't know, like, okay, so 400 ringgit, let's say, okay, 400 ringgit is like 100 USD. If you were to get people to pay that for local ingredients and flavors that they think that they can get on the street for way less, then we have a problem, you know, because a lot of people will be like, but those ingredients, I could get that for a tenth of the price or a third of the price. Why would I fork out so much money? Well, it's not that they're doing this just so that it could, you know, get lots of money. It's experimenting with local ingredients and local flavors, but changing the shape of the stuff we're familiar with. You know, so you do that particularly with modern techniques, modern scientific techniques. You know, they like doing this foam, like doing foam and, or fermentation, which you borrow from, you know, Korea or Chinese, traditionally Korean or traditionally Chinese or even Japanese methods. Right? So it's changing the shape of the things we understand and not serving the same ingredients in the same way that you could get as, you know, like home cooking or as street food.
Mm-hmm. So what would need to happen to make those quote-unquote authentic or traditional methods worth the money or worth it to the high-paying customer?
I think this is how I see it. I don't see that the same people who are eating the, you know, our much more affordable food being the ones going to the fine dining places. I think that the mark that these chefs are making is at that fine cuisine, fine dining level. So, for example, Darren Teo, as a Malaysian chef, made it onto the top 50 Asia's best restaurants or chefs. Dewakan, the restaurant that he runs, so he's very, very emphatic about saying that it's very much a team effort because, you know, they experiment as a group to come up with these dishes. So that, so he Dewakan got placed at number 48 out of 50. And if you actually look at the restaurants on that list, you know, Asia's best restaurants, and the top is actually a French restaurant led by a French chef in Singapore. Right? And if you look at, you know, a lot of those restaurants, you know, some that are based out in Shanghai, they're actually led by European chefs, and they could be doing French cuisine with an Asian twist, but not many of them are proudly selling their ethnic food or their national cuisine, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting, right? Because it then shows you that the Asian market is still very much colonized. We still think about, if we're going to spend this much money, it's got to be Western food.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think that it's important that you focus on local ingredients, but at that kind of level, at that fine dining level, because you're making a mark by saying, look, Malaysian cuisine can be a top restaurant for its own sake. You know, it doesn't have to be a European restaurant. So there's some focusing on local ingredients. And there are other people who call their food modern Malaysian because they use French techniques, and the food then comes out looking more French than Malaysian. So I think that has to be clear, that these restaurants are different because they actually, people, the work that Darren is doing, or Raymond, Tom and Beta, and I think there's a new one called Atas as well. They're focusing on local ingredients much more. Mm-hmm.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back after a short break.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
So we were just discussing the deployment of French techniques and ingredients in modern Malaysian food. And very quickly, with our last 10 minutes, if you could give an explanation on how this is also happening with South Korean food and kind of having to translate that for a Western narrative.
Uh-oh.
big topic.
Where? Like in Korean food in general?
Mm-hmm. You talk about the Hanseok globalization campaign.
Actually, the Hanseok globalization campaign, in Malaysia, it's still much more traditional, and I think that trying to the South Korean government has been trying to promote Korean food to be on the global stage as, you know, the top five. And this was actually a campaign that started under the previous two governments ago than the previous one, and it was meant. At that time, it would be like 2012 or 14, I forget. I started quite early, and they had a long-term plan. Let's just say they haven't quite succeeded. So in their campaign, they targeted not just local, not just Korean barbecue. They target different levels. So you have, you know, trying to promote Korean barbecue and bibimbap and sort of traditional Korean dishes. They also tried to promote Korean cuisine. And then they also focused on Korean chefs overseas in Western countries, Europe and the U.S., who are doing modern food or trying with a Korean twist. Or they're also trying to target French chefs to try and get them to use Korean ingredients or Korean techniques in their food. Actually, you know, these government promotion things, they're basically, they have an agenda, right? It's not a kind of, we're so proud of our culture, we want you to share it. It's also meant to try to promote their industry and their tourism and their products overseas, you know, to kind of export their products overseas.
This campaign overlooks some major issues that are happening locally, and which are those issues?
For example, in Malaysia, my argument is that in my Gastronomica essay, my argument is that the campaign is very much let out of South Korea So it doesn't really take into consideration how South Korean food is, or, well, also North Korean food, I suppose, how South Korean food is localized or adapted in Malaysia, and it doesn't actually consider the market so much in Malaysia. So if they did that, they would be much more sensitive and attuned to local audiences. So, for example, they put out like a restaurant guide of Korean restaurant guide in Malaysia, in KL and Jakarta. So it's like a joint guidebook that featured, I'm not sure if it's like 20 restaurants in KL and 20 restaurants in Jakarta. And they have like an index section, and they try to be sensitive by having the guidebook be in bilingual or trilingual. Okay, so for the Malaysian section, they have it in Malay, and then in Korean, and then in English. And the interesting thing is that they don't realize that if you're a Malay audience reading this book, you probably would want to know if it's halal or not. You know, so in the index, you should actually have a line that tells people if that particular restaurant is halal or not. So they didn't have that in mind, and they don't realize that most of the people frequenting Korean restaurants are actually Chinese Malaysians. Like, so to have it in Malay assumes that the readers would be reading in Malay. But actually, if they're Chinese, they're probably reading it in English or in Chinese first, rather than reading it in Malay, because Malaysia is very racialized. We're split because of certain policies that privilege and prioritize Malays, that prioritize the Malay language as the national language, as Malaysia's official language. You know, so they made these gaps in coming up with the restaurant guide, even though they get the reviewers who are Malaysians, you know. So those are the little things. And also they don't consider that they're not really giving incentives to Korean migrants in Malaysia who open up Korean restaurants, right? They're not giving them, they're not helping them to promote their restaurants or helping them set up restaurants in Malaysia. And the people I interviewed, the Koreans I interviewed who run these restaurants, feel that it's probably that if the government were to help anybody, they would be helping the big conglomerates who are opening restaurants overseas, but who also sell products, etc. They're the big chaebols, you know, and they're just a handful of them, rather than these of mom and pop stores.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's this common thread in your writing where you're attempting to sort out or discover public spaces, tangible and not, where we all can eat together. How are spaces like these created, and how can they be effective instead of like this pamphlet just falling flat?
How can they be created? Mm-hmm. I think in Malaysia right now, they would probably have to be halal. So some of the Korean restaurant operators I talked to are very much aware of that. Some Korean restaurants have become halal in order to welcome Malay Muslims or Muslim customers. And since I wrote that article, which was a few years ago when I did the research, Korean dramas, Korean pop bands, the Korean wave is huge in Malaysia. Like, you have these boy bands come, and there's a lot of fans who go, and some fans would actually go to Korea and visit these places and go to attend a concert, things like that. So the Korean restaurants are very much aware of the influence of pop, K-pop in Malaysia, and it's because of K-pop that these restaurants have an appeal, K-dramas that these restaurants have an appeal. So they now know that they have to kind of become halal to appeal to the audience. So gradually you're seeing more of these sort of halal places, but not all, because you know, pork is just as important to Koreans, I think, as they are to Chinese. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with modern Malaysian food, how to create a cuisine that is fully representative of the people it's claiming to represent and serving the people it represents?
I don't think that they claim to represent the different ethnicities. I think what Darren Teo is, you know, he's a very thoughtful chef. You know, he's thinking about the history. He reads a lot. And he's actually kind of going back to the roots, you know, what was there, what did people eat before migrants came, you know, before the Chinese and the Indians came, before people from, before, you know, Indonesia, before people from the other islands came, right? What did the indigenous people, the Orang Asli, the Orang Asal, eat? And maybe it's not a lot, you know, tubers, they had to use their herbal, but so it's really trying to look at indigenous people's cuisine and or indigenous people's ingredients and trying to incorporate that into these dishes. And these indigenous cuisine or indigenous ingredients were also used by Malays, and Orang Asli also kind of incorporated later ingredients, whether it's brought by Malays or Chinese, etc. So, like, if you think about it, it's a tropical country. You can't really grow garlic. So what did indigenous people use to kind of flavor their food or their meat? They use a leaf called daun semomo, which actually smells like, it smells like this smelly insect. I'm not sure what it's called in English, but in Malay it's called pijat. You know, sometimes there's this insect, I don't know if you have it in the States, and you kind of kill it by pressing it, and then you smell your fingers and it's got this like real strong smell. It has that smell. Mm-hmm. But when you cook it, I know it maybe, you know, the smell kind of doesn't sort of stay there, and it flavors the food. Mm-hmm. So that was what people or indigenous people used in their food before we started to import garlic and onions and stuff like that. And now, of course, garlic and onions have become a staple in our recipes. And when I went recently to an indigenous village, and we had a food tour, and they cooked their food for us in their traditional ways, they were also busy peeling garlic. You know? Mm-hmm. So you can see how it's difficult to kind of go back to this sort of purest, authentic origin from 200, 300 years ago, before the British came, before the migrant, you know, Chinese and Indians came, because we use all these things and we adapt the stuff that comes in, mm-hmm. you know, like tomatoes, right? Tomatoes originated from Latin America, but they were brought to Malaya, to the peninsula via trade and the Portuguese, etc.
Mm-hmm. That was a perfectly short and sweet intro to Malaysian cuisine, and now I'm going to run off and try to find what that insect is. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.